And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Born during the despair of the Great Depression, tempered by the fires of the Second World War, on a parallel Earth very much like our own, yet slightly different, they're banded together the greatest forces for freedom ever assembled. Over the many ensuing years, new and younger members would join the veteran champions of the Golden Age, continuing their fight for truth, justice, and the American way. Becoming so much more than just heroes, they became legends. Back to the Bins proudly presents Legends of the Justice Society of America.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a long-awaited return of sorts to Legends of the Justice Society. We are currently joining in the very large podcast endeavor of JS April, and we are covering an episode or an issue, or actually kind of an issue and a half, of the Justice Society's stories. So we're coming off track of what the Legends is, so we'll consider this kind of a point one episode. We're just happy to join in the festivities because, as you may or may not know, we love the Justice Society. I'm Paul Spitaro, and I am here with my fellow Justice Society lover, Mr. Scott Gardner.
Hello! How's it going?
It's going pretty well. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm very, very, very excited to talk about the books that we have today. Because, yes, you are right. We are both big Justice Society fans. And, this is a favorite. Good stuff.
Yeah. We were approached to see if we cared to participate and indicated that we did. And I selected DC Special number 29, which has the untold origin of the Justice Society. I have a mangled tongue today, apparently, which is just a long been a favorite of mine. And I've been kind of waiting to do this for a long time, so I'm happy that we're getting a chance to. But Mr. Gardner, in his infinite or finite wisdom, suggested that we also touch on Secret Origins number 31, which retells the same tale in an effort to get it in line with Crisis on Infinite Earths and how that changed history. So we're going to... I would expect we're going to do a deep dive on DC Special and then kind of a review of Secret Origins, unless Mr. Gardner thinks otherwise. And he is the one who prepared our synopsis, so he is going to be steering the ship, not me. So as an aside, Scott, what's your familiarity with the Justice Society? Have you ever read anything by them?
It's funny you should ask. So one of the reasons I'm really excited to do this is I did this very much old school tales method. And what I mean by that is anybody that is familiar with my podcasting history is probably aware that many moons ago, I used to participate in a podcast that we did called Tales of the Justice Society of America, where starting with the All-Star Revival, All-Star Comics number 58, I believe it is, where the All-Stars came back in the 70s. We were just, chronologically going through the history of the Justice Society of America. And I remember when this book came up and just being so excited to finally tackle it. And I mean, gosh, I don't even know how many years ago that was now. It's got to be like 15 or more years ago. But this, like you said, this is always a fan favorite of mine as well. I really enjoy this issue for a variety of reasons, and I'm just looking forward to, any excuse to dig out, especially the 70s era Justice Society stuff and reexamine that. I'm always up for that, always itching for that. So I tried not to go too nuts with, a massive synopsis and a zillion notes, but I probably failed spectacularly. So I hope the listeners are ready for some old school colossal podcasting, because this one's going to be chock full of good stuff. So, But unless we have anything else, I'll go ahead and dive straight into this.
Like a good plan to me.
All right. So again, this is DC Special number 29. Just for trivia's sake, this was the last issue of DC Special that was published. Cover date on this is August/September 1977. The on sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, was May 12th, 1977. I was all of 9 years old. Cover price on this, 60 cents, which was a lot for the time period. Cover artist, Neil Adams on this one. And it is a spectacular cover featuring just about everybody that's in the book is, you know, hero-wise, with the notable exception of Sandman for some reason. But it is the Justice Society rushing in from the left side of the page. Superman is baffing a bomb, which I'm not sure that's the smartest thing in the world, to punch a bomb the way he is, but he's punching a bomb. And at the bottom of the page, you've got a kindly old Uncle Adolf holding the Spear of Destiny, and he's ranting and raving about something or other. Oh, and you got some Valkyries on there too, but it's just, it's an awesome, you know, I mean, it's Neil Adams. It's just a beautiful, beautiful cover, and it's really cool. This is the untold origin of the Justice Society. Writer on this is Paul Levitz. Artists were Joe Staton and Bob Layton, and you'd be hard pressed to find a better art team than that. Now, before I begin the synopsis on this, a word on the origin of the untold origin of the Justice Society. This issue was published in between issues 67 and 68 of the All-Star Comics revival in the 1970s. And it came about because a fan, this guy named Charlie Patterson of Huntington Beach, California, wrote into All-Star Comics asking for them to please reprint the JSA's origin. DC was fresh off the publication of Secret Origins of the Super DC Heroes at the time, and they rushed to comply, only to discover that nowhere in its 57-issue original Golden Age run, nor anywhere in the handful of issues published during its then-ongoing revival period, had the origin of the JSA ever actually been told. They didn't have one. And so to correct this unfortunate oversight, the following tale was created. So in the winter of 1940, November specifically, as we would eventually come to learn in America versus the Justice Society, on the world known as Earth 2, Adolf Hitler abandoned plans to invade England. To this day, no one knows why. No one but the 10 heroes who battled across two continents to ruin those plans and give birth to a legend. We are treated to a gorgeous splash page featuring not only the 10 heroes, but pretty near the full roster of the Justice Society of America as it existed at the time of this book's publication. You got Mr. Terrific, Dr. Midnight, Johnny Thunder and his Thunderbolt, the Red Tornado, both of them, Ma Hunkle and the Android flavor, the Sandman, the Atom, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, the Spectre, Black Canary, Starman, Dr. Fate, the Flash, Hawkman, Power Girl, the Hourman, the Star-Spangled Kid, Wildcat, Green Lantern, and Robin. Not sure who else might be missing off the top of my head, but I did notice the Huntress is conspicuously absent. That's why I said near full roster. Anyway, our story begins with a prologue. We are reminded it is 1940 and that the Nazi juggernaut sweeps across Europe. World War II has not yet officially begun and America has not yet entered the war. FDR has just been reelected to an unprecedented third term in office and has promised America peace, and he is hard-pressed to keep that promise. A man named Smythe is admitted into the White House and meets with FDR in the Oval Office. Smythe comes representing someone known simply as Intrepid and reveals information obtained at the cost of many Bothans that Hitler plans to invade England. Smythe has been sent to ask for America's help in this moment of crisis, but FDR cites his promise to the American people that he would not lead them into war unless the U.S. were attacked. However, feeling he must do something, he makes a bold proposal and pulls from a top secret file the photos of several mystery men. that have appeared across the country in the last few months. Costume heroes with more power and daring than ordinary mortals. Perhaps, says the president, they are your answer. 1 week later in Gotham City, the Batman answers Commissioner Gordon's summons via the Bat Signal, which retroactively places this use of the device before its actual first ever use in the comics in 1942. Gordon reassures Batman that there is no danger to Gotham this night, but instead introduces him to two other men of mystery, the Flash from Keystone City, and Green Lantern, a fellow Gothamite crime fighter, although the two have never crossed paths until just now. Introductions are cut short by Smythe, who is all business, and gets right to the point that he wants the heroes to go on a secret mission that he hopes will save the British people. And so the three mystery men are off to Glasgow, Scotland, and McMurdo Castle, which British intelligence has learned that the Nazis are using as a base from which to stage the invasion. The heroes strike, with GL battering the wooden castle door with a power ring-generated battering ram, something he shouldn't be able to do given his ring's vulnerability to all things wood, but he was hoping that no one would notice, and laying into the Nazis inside. At first, the heroes are doing pretty well, but the tables turn quickly when head Nazi Striker, summons essentially what looks to me like one of those Red Skull sleepers from Tales of Suspense 72 through 74. The giant Nazi robot makes quick work of Batman, Flash, and GL, and the heroes are knocked out and locked up. Meanwhile, half a world away in Salem, Massachusetts, Dr. Fate has been watching the goings-on via his mystic crystal and decides it is time to act. He flies from his stone tower and snaps up one Rex Tyler, the Hourman, along the way. Later in Berlin, Uncle Adolf himself rants and raves to his people about Aryan supremacy and blah, 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 while waving the Spear of Destiny around and proposing to use it on the three captured heroes that have been brought before him. But before the Fuhrer can get all stabby, Doc Fate and Hourman show up to free Batman and his pals. Hitler's now really pissed and uses the Spear of Destiny, a Christian religious artifact, to summon the Valkyries of Norse myth? Okay, yeah. So while the good guys are occupied battling the Valkyries, Adolf orders the invasion to begin, and so the Nazi naval fleet sets sail for unsuspecting Britain. Dr. Fate decides to bring in reinforcements and sends forth mystic tendrils that span the ocean and snatch up the Sandman, the Atom, and Hawkman, and whisk them away to join the fight. Unnoticed by the trio is a fourth tendril and the ghostly image of the being it has summoned. The tendrils drop the trio in Dover, England, where they back up the valiant guardians of the British Isles as they fight to repel the Nazi invasion. The newly arrived heroes seem to be doing a good job and even congratulate themselves on a successful defense, but then realize upon seeing the rest of the approaching Nazi fleet that this was just the first wave and that they are hopelessly outnumbered and outmatched. But hope is not lost as, silhouetted against the moon, the ghostly shape of that fourth summoned being takes form and is revealed to be the Spectre. Back in Berlin, Hitler is disgusted to see the five heroes successfully repelling the Valkyries and orders the immediate launch of their experimental long-range bomber. Target, Washington, D.C., and President Roosevelt. In the English Channel, the Spectre makes like Gulliver and absolutely trashes the Nazi fleet, leaving no ship nor sailor intact. This unsettles his companions, Hawkman, the Atom, and Sandman, but the Spectre assures them that he has nothing, that they have nothing to fear from him, and that he serves the cause of life. Just then, the five other heroes, who were just in Berlin a moment ago, arrive, and for the first time, the nine superheroes are gathered together in a moment of triumph. However, it is short-lived as Fate senses great evil in the air above them, and the heroes quickly realize that the Valkyrie are back, and this time they are flying escort to the bomber bound for Washington. And so the heroes battle the Valkyrie and fight their advance all the way across the Atlantic until eventually they see the approaching coastline and the U.S. Capitol. things look bad, and they realize that for all their power, they cannot stop the Valkyrie or halt the bomber. But then suddenly, leaping up from the press building, Green Lantern witnesses an incredible sight, a last-minute reprieve. It's Superman! The mighty Man of Steel shatters the bomber and catches the warhead, not allowing it to burst upon his chest. While this is happening, the Valkyrie managed to knock out GL, causing him and those he was carrying in a power ring bubble to plummet out of the sky. Adam, dazed, struggles to remain conscious and manages to take the full brunt of a death blow intended for FDR. Superman arrives and grabs the Valkyrie who fired it, but she and her sisters suddenly vanish, presumably summoned back to wherever they came from. The Mighty Might, somehow, survives the power blast, making a lame joke about how you can't split an atom. Well impressed, the president suggests the assembled heroes, the greatest the nation has ever known, would make a snappy army regiment. Superman suggests that rather than being part of any army, they form a team to fight only in the cause of justice, and suggests the name, the Justice Society of America. And thus, a legend was born. All right, so real quick, historical notes from the All-Star Companion, Volume 3. I told you this was old school tales podcasting, folks. Here we go. All right, so just a few brief notes here in the book. The Englishman who tells FDR of Hitler's plan is an agent for William Stephenson, or Stevenson, co-author and hero of the best-selling 1976 memoir, A Man Called Intrepid. An American-bound German bomber at the story's climax is based on the real-life New York bomber planned by Nazi technicians, a plan capable of flying all the way to Europe to drop a load of bombs on New York City. And I'm pretty sure that's where they got the same idea for Captain America First Avenger, right? Because that's the whole climax of that movie. The origin, I'll cover reprints in my notes section, but it basically tells where it's reprinted. The post-Crisis on Infinite Earth version of this tale, minus Superman and Batman, was related in Secret Origins number 31, and we will cover that shortly. As was admitted in a later All-Star Letters section, Green Lantern's power ring could not actually have smashed through the heavy oaken doors of a Scottish castle therein. Let's see, what else is relevant here? Talks about how a year later, after this, Roy Thomas would do a very similar story using Thor in Invaders number 32 for Marvel Comics. And it talks about the Spear of Destiny, whose origins are discussed at some length in All-Star Comics Companion, All-Star Companion, rather, Volume 2, was first introduced into the DC Universe in Weird Western Tales number 50, a book that I still have not been able to successfully track down, but I did mean to read digitally before sitting down to this recording, and I just never did get around to it. But I'm very curious about that. I've always wanted to read that particular story. Have you ever read that one?
Yeah, no, I have not. And I noticed, I saw the note of that also and was, ooh, it would be access to it at the moment.
Yeah, I would I'd like to check that out. But yeah, that's it for the historical notes section. What you got on this one?
So continuing your historical notes section, I actually did a little bit of research on this one, which goes against my normal grain where I just dive into these things and read them. But I've read this one many times over the years, and I don't have the familiarity with all the subtleties of World War II or the, you know, the dates and everything, when everything went on. I kind of wish Dave was with us because I think he probably does have a greater knowledge than either of us. But starting with William Stevenson, who was, you know, given the code name Intrepid that you mentioned earlier, that book that he wrote, A Man Called Intrepid, that actually was made into a miniseries in the late 70s, which I've never seen. And it starred David Niven as William Stevenson. The character is actually Canadian, or the person is actually Canadian, but worked for British Security Coordination. And the there is a theory out there that he inspired Ian Fleming to create James Bond.
You know, I think I'd heard that before. Now that you say that, that sounds familiar. That rings a bell.
Huh. So that's a very cool aspect of it, I thought.
Well, didn't Niven play Bond in, or am I wrong?
Yes, he played him in the original Casino Royale, it was.
Yeah.
But that was not really a much of a show, but whatever. Anyway, I looked up McMurdry Castle, which is, you know, the place in Glasgow that they're defending,
right,
or that the Nazis are taking over. And the only entries I could find with my Google search were about the comic book. So I assume that's a fictional castle, as well as Helmut Stryker. I looked up, and he also seems to be fictional.
I have a note on that guy when we get to it.
Okay. Do you want to give it now, or you want to hold?
Yeah, sure. I did not realize this until looking at Mike's Amazing World. He's the Red Panzer, and I did not realize that. So he hadn't become the Red Panzer yet, in this part of the timeline. But that would happen eventually. He was primarily like a Wonder Woman Nazi supervillain guy. I won't pretend to know a lot about him because I don't, but I recognize the name and I know the look of the guy. And he was always one of those characters that you'd kind of make fun of, you know, the Red Panzer. Everybody called him the Red Pansy, you know. But he was kind of cool. He was, you know, in that same vein of like Baron Blitzkrieg, or who was the super Nazi guy that Captain America fought, the Overman or whatever his name was, you know, those types.
Oh, you did. It was in the Invaders. He came.
Masterman, was that it?
Masterman. Yes.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So yeah, but yeah, I didn't recognize his actual, you know, his real name of Helmut Stryker meant nothing to me, but I thought that was neat to discover who he actually is, or who he would become, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. The S-ware that they mention in there, I had never heard that term. I just, you know, not familiar with it, but that's just the title for the German military intelligence unit.
Mm.
I was a little curious about Normandy, because, you know, I think we all know historically that in 1944, D-Day took place in Normandy, and that was, you know, very, very big. But in this, they have the Nazis invading Normandy in 1940. So I'm not familiar with that particular historical event. I mean, was that, I assume there's some nexus to that, but I couldn't really find anything with that.
I thought that's, no, I could be wrong. Let me flip back to that part, because I made note of the mention of Normandy, but I thought that's where Yeah, okay, so let's see here. This is on page 14. It says, British intelligence is confused by the capture of their American allies and wait patiently for the news of the invasion date, never dreaming that in Normandy, the mightiest fleet in naval history is sailing toward. So the invasion this time doesn't take place in Normandy. It sounds like the British fleet was sailing from Normandy. Does that follow? Because the big battle takes place in Dover, England.
Right.
And yes. Normandy's in France, right? So
is
France occupied yet in 1940?
That's what I'm trying to piece out in my mind. And I guess we could put the call to anybody who listens to this, including Dave, to let us know. Because you think you learn stuff in school and you think you kind of know the order of things, and then you realize how ignorant you are sometimes.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of actually, you know, makes me sad sometimes to know that I know less than I think I do. But, you know, I think that's reality for a lot of us probably. Well, that's it for my historical notes.
I looked it up real quick, you know, just typing it into Google. It says here, Nazi Germany invaded France in May 1940, and after a swift campaign, France signed an armistice on June 24th, 1940, leading to the occupation of northern and western France by German forces. So, yeah, I guess they had by that point.
So, you know, I mean, it sounds to me like in writing this version of it, you know, they did a little bit of research. What is it? Paul Levitz did a little bit of research into, you know, the actual events and tried to tie in the JSA to those events, which is, you know, I appreciate that effort.
Okay, this is freaky. I'm sorry. I'm so tangenting right now, but underneath what I just read was a picture that I'm like, that can't be real. So I clicked on it, and it is a real picture of Hitler, and I don't know who the other guys with him are. They're posing in front of, it's basically, it's on the steps of, I forget what the name of that place was, but it's basically with the Eiffel Tower in the background. I have literally stood at the exact same spot that Hitler is in this picture, and that gives me chills. That's wow. I had no idea. You realize he'd ever even been to Paris. That's weird. That's unsettling. Anyway, moving quickly on.
So my other notes on this really are with regard to the comic book as opposed to history.
Right.
So I think, you know, we can get into all of that if you want.
Let's just kind of go in order here, I guess. We'll just kind of flip through the book.
Start with the cover.
Okay.
You know, Neil Adams cover, which, you know, I been on the record. I have yet to find Neil Adams things that I don't like.
Right.
That said, I feel like this cover is just not quite up to what I'm used to from it. It's not bad by any stretch. It's a good cover, but I'm just not sure, like, that it kind of gets the whole point across that it's trying here. I mean, I'm trying to remember now, and I did not make a note. Apparently, they had listed an inker for it, and it was someone else named Adams, but I don't know if there's any relation to Neil, a woman artist. For all I know, it could have been his wife, it could have been his daughter. I don't know. But it just doesn't look as clean. And I think part of my problem with this is almost the yellow orange background.
Yeah.
I don't think it's so much the rendering as it is that. And I'm not totally crazy about the appearance of the way Hitler looks on the cover, although he's ranting and raving with the Spear of Destiny in his hand, which is kind of, you know, true to the story, which is cool. You know, it is effective that what we're getting in this on this cover kind of shows us what we get in the story, but it just feels like there's so much going on that a lot of it gets lost in translation.
It's busy. I think that's the biggest, I don't want to say problem with it, but the biggest issue with it is it is very busy. It's very, everything's very crammed. I almost wish this was a wraparound cover. I think if it had been a wraparound cover, then it'd be able to breathe a little more, if you know what I mean.
You could have done it as a wraparound cover with the JSA actually heading in the other direction so that when you had the back cover open, that's where you see the Valkyries and the bomb and all of that.
Right. I wonder if I know you and I are not fans of empty backgrounds, but I wonder if it was just white behind them would work better. But then the problem, of course, would be that the Valkyrie horses are all white. So then they wouldn't necessarily pop.
I wonder if it would look better if it had an all black background.
Or black might work. Yeah.
That would allow everything to pop a little bit.
But I do like it. Honestly,
yes, it's almost like I like it despite the criticism I have for it.
Yeah, yeah. My only real issue with it, honestly, other than that orange, is I wish Superman... Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing Adam's Superman at all because I love Adam's Superman. I dearly wish he had done more Superman in his career. You know, I mean, he did so many covers and things that are just fantastic, some of my personal favorites, but I wish he had done more Superman because I love his version of Superman. But this is his version of Superman, just with a different S symbol on his chest. I wish he had done a little more to differentiate him, like make him look like a golden, like just a different version of Superman, because this basically looks like, oh, it's Neil Adams Superman. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'm trying to think of how he could differentiate him, though, because, you know, it is taking place in 1940, so you're not going to give him the great temples or anything like that.
Right, but Superman hadn't quite gelled yet as early as 1940. I mean, he was still finding his look, if you know what I mean. So, I
I
mean,
think
he could
you
have
could
been
have
a
made him a
little
little
more
bit
retro.
more. I think you could have made him a little bit more barrel chested because he was drawn more that way early
Yeah.
on. I do think, you know, again, he did this, he kind of adopted the symbol, and it's a smaller S than he would do in later issues, which is more to the Golden Age look.
Right.
I think facially he could have. Like, that looks like 1970s Superman to me
Yeah.
facially. And I
Yeah.
think he could have just, you know, made the hair a little shorter and, you know, just, yeah, like you said, differentiate him in more subtle ways.
Give him the squinty, because Superman back then had that squinty look. You know, he always looked like
Squinky.
squinky. Yeah, very much so. So, yeah, just, I mean,
What
most of
squinky eyes?
it. It's a minor criticism, but yeah, I just wish he was just, you know, a little more differentiated. But then again, you know, if you're looking to sell the book, I mean, yes, 70s Adam Superman is, yeah, that's going to sell the book. So,
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I bought this off the stands, so certainly the cover was, you know, part of my process, because this literally I bought off the stands as opposed to from a comic store or anything like that. You know, this was at a candy store.
I did not, and it's lost to time now where I acquired that. I've owned this issue as long as I can remember, so I have no memory anymore of where I acquired it or when I first read it. It's just always kind of been there, but yeah.
For what it's
Cool.
worth, the copy I had of this had some water damage to the cover. It had that, you know, crinkly look from it, and I recently bought a new copy of this from the dollar bins.
Wow, that's a good score, because this one's climbing. This one's yeah, I don't know these days what it let's see, I can take a quick look here and just get an idea what it might be
So,
going
and while
for.
you're looking that up, I'm going to mention that, you know, because you mentioned it already, so I don't want to waste too much time on it. But I feel like Bob Layton really complimented Joe Staton a lot in this book, and I'm going to kind of just talk about that for a minute because I've always loved Joe Staton's art, and to some extent, I feel like that goes against my normal thoughts, because Joe Staton is not as clean of a look as my favorite artists are. But for whatever reason, he has stood out to me as one of the people whose artwork I really enjoy. But Bob Layton very much has that clean look to his art. So when you combine the two, you get you don't it doesn't look like it's Joe Staton that's been Laytonized. On the other hand, it does look very clean. So you still have Joe Staton's style coming through. While it's cleaned up a little bit by Leighton, and I just think the combination is tremendous. My biggest problem with the artwork in it is really silly, but just the size of FDR's glasses on his face, the big fat face that they draw with those tiny little glasses, just doesn't look right. So I actually did an image search for FDR to try and see, did he wear like really tiny glasses? Most of the images online when I did that have him without glasses. But I, you know, I didn't did an image search. I put FDR and glasses, and a couple of shots came up, and they were not tiny like that. And also, his face isn't as fat as the way they draw it in here. So that's the one thing historically that doesn't look right to me. But otherwise, I really don't even have any criticism of the art anywhere in it. There was nothing that took me out of the story. I think some of the images are tremendous. The storytelling is outstanding, and I think that may be one of the things that I've always enjoyed about Staton is his storytelling is really solid. But some of the images, you know, like the Germans coming into Dover, and you know, some shots with the Valkyries, and especially the two shots, Spectre, you know, the giant Spectre going after the ships, and Superman punching the bomb, are all just really top notch to me. You know, they're like poster images, or even Superman catching the bomb rather. So, you know, the artwork in this is just outstanding. Did you find a price on the book, by the way?
I did. A couple of things here. For one, I was noticing, and I didn't really notice this until you pointed it out, but looking at page three with FDR, I think his face looks fatter than it would otherwise if he didn't have the glasses. But I'm also noticing they're not glasses. They're actually those, what do they call them? Pince-nez? I'm not sure how you pronounce that. But it's the ones that they sit on your nose. They pinch your nose, but they don't have the sidebar to hold the glasses over your ears type of thing.
Which is historically accurate with the pictures I saw.
Yeah, yeah. So I looked that up to see if there were pictures of him wearing those. And the ones that I found, they're just old enough and fuzzy enough that I can't quite tell if they are glasses or the pinch things. But even those, they're not that tiny. They're bigger than that. So yeah, that is a little bit weird. It makes his face look a lot fatter than I think otherwise would look.
It's interesting that they just show FDR really sitting, and you know that they didn't show anything with him in a wheelchair or anything like that.
Right, right. I like that. And I wonder if that's intentional because that's historically accurate that, you know, the reporter, you know, the press back then was respectful enough of him that they typically didn't show him in that light either. And I think that's kind of neat. So I wonder if that was intentional by the artists in this.
I suspect that it was. You know, not that they wanted to make a big deal out of it. Obviously, it's a more subtle point, but that they were not going to show him in any other way than what his public persona showed.
So I looked this up in Key Collector real quick because I was just curious. And low end is $3, high end is $25, according to them. So I thought it had actually priced higher than that, but still, yeah, that's not bad, and it's climbing. So finding it in the dollar bin, especially if it's in real good shape, that was a score. Yeah, this is considered a key issue because of it being the origin of the Justice Society, and the other note they have is just final issue. So I guess that I wouldn't think of that as being necessarily a key feature, but I guess it must be according to them. My first note on this, and this ties into page three here, and it's one of my bigger notes on the issue in particular, is why Batman? And for that matter, why Superman? Now, I love the Superman moment in this. I think it's wonderful. I think it fits with the whole vibe of the story and historically with the JSA. The reason I say why Batman primarily is because while they were technically members of the JSA, neither Superman or Batman really had a hell of a lot to do with the JSA during the publishing run. The All-Star Comics and the team, because the membership would change a lot over time, you know, people would come in, people would drop out. It was kind of meant to showcase the other heroes. You know, Superman and Batman were already superstars. They already had their own books. You know, in the case of both of them, you know, they both had a couple of books. You know, Batman had Batman and Detective, Superman had Action and Superman, plus they each had stories in World's Finest. So they were getting plenty of exposure, and you know, they were superstar characters. So All-Star really showcased a lot of the other characters. And I kind of feel like with this being the origin of the team, that it should have kept that same flavor of it showcasing the characters that would pretty much come to star in All-Star and be the regular, at least the founding members of the Justice Society. So the inclusion of Batman just seems kind of odd to me because that makes him essentially a founding member and very core to this particular story. But then after that, I mean, off the top of my head, I think Superman and Batman were only in two other stories. One of them was a cameo appearance, and then one of them, they're kind of part of the story, but still, even in that story, not like a big part of the story. And I can't.
You know what I saw, I think, said they were in three issues.
Oh, is it three? Okay.
If that's accurate.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? It just, I like having Batman here, and I love Staten and Layton's Batman, but it just seems odd to me because he is kind of a big deal in the story, yet he's not a big deal in the team beyond this point. And that just seems a little odd to me.
One of the things one of my notes was that I liked was, even though Superman is given a very dramatic entrance and an important entrance into this story, they allowed the Atom to kind of have the most dramatic moment of saving FDR. Yeah. And I thought that was a good thing. And for exactly the reasons that you're talking about, since Superman and Batman, I almost feel like they had to be included here because they are the two DC flagship characters.
Right.
And as much as you want to include Wonder Woman or Green Lantern or the Flash or anybody else in that pantheon, I mean, they're all significant DC characters, but Superman and Batman are the flag holders. There's no question.
Right.
And I think that's why they are put in here. And it's, what's funny is that the issue that we're going to cover in a moment, that's exactly why the story had to be rewritten, is because they shouldn't have been in there.
Right.
So I find that amusing. But, you know, I thought Superman's moment was definitely, you know, if this was a theatrical thing, that was, you know, Captain America getting Thor's hammer in Endgame, you know, when Superman just comes flying in and takes care of the plane and the bomb. So it would be, you know, made for a very dramatic and enjoyable, you know, like a pump your fist moment.
Yeah.
And not only is it a pump your fist moment, but when, you know, the first appearance, he's coming through with his fist in the air, like he's pumping his own fist. So, you know, I think that's really cool. But again, I like the fact that you let Adam, who's really the least powerful of all of the assembled heroes in this book, have the key moment of saving the president's life.
Yep. And it wouldn't be until All-Star Squadron number 7 where we finally get an explanation of... So in this, he takes a death blast, literally a blast intended to kill the president. He takes it full in the chest. And then a moment later, he's just seen to be kind of shrugging it off. And, you know, and he makes the joke about, oh, you can't split an atom. But there's not really anything in between to explain, okay, well, how did he survive that? So in All-Star Comics number 7, FDR has a comment that finally kind of explains it. He says that essentially Dr. Fate drew out the deadly magic, kind of like sucking out a poison from the spear that the Valkyrie had stabbed or shot the blast with to the Atom. So it was basically Dr. Fate saved his life. We don't get that in this story, but that's revealed later on. So, hey, at least it's an explanation, because otherwise it just doesn't seem... it's a very cool moment when he takes the blast, but then a moment later, as I say, he's perfectly all right with no explanation.
Yeah, definitely. And you know what? Honestly, I read through it and it was like, okay, yeah, he's still alive. It didn't even occur to me to question that.
But I agree with you on the Superman moment. When he comes, my two favorite moments, the two moments that make this issue for me, the Superman moment's number one, because it's a full page splash. It comes out of nowhere. I mean, other than the fact that Superman was on the cover, you know, it's easy to, as you get into the, I mean, this is 29 pages into the story before Superman shows up. It's easy to kind of forget, oh yeah, Superman's going to be in this at some point. So when he shows up, it is a big deal. It's a very cool moment. You know, he literally saves the day. He saves the president. He saves Washington, democracy, you know, the whole schmeal. So that's very cool. My number two moment is the Spectre. That scene of him, you know, wading through the channel and taking out the Nazi, that's cool. That is very cool. I always thought that was really neat. And holding up the ship captain in the palm of his hand and giving him the stare of death. And all, I mean, that's classic Spectre. It's very cool.
And one of my notes is that the Spectre is killing these people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I always find that to be... not questionable. In fact, I find it to be almost, you know, realistic. But, you know, with the Comics Code Authority and all, you know, you would think that they would be hesitant to have such a very clear fact that he's killing people presented. But, you know, they do make it clear. And I think, if I'm remembering now from just my reread recently, is he kind of almost gives the guy the choice. You know, that the guy, you know, you can walk away and not die, and the guy chooses to get the death stare.
I kind of wonder if it's also one of those things of, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, but when it's Nazis, it's okay. And I kind of wonder if that might have something to do with it as well. It's like, normally, you know, if this was like Joe Bank Robber and he did this, maybe the comics code would object. But seeing as how it's, you know, literally a Nazi, you know, fleet captain, then it's okay. Also, I'm trying to remember the timeline. This may be contemporaneous with the era where in Adventure Comics, the Spectre was literally chopping people in half with a pair of scissors or melting them like a candle too. So
could be.
All right. As much as I love this story and have always loved this story, I do have a complaint. It's something that has always bothered me about this. And I like that it kind of sort of gets addressed a little bit in the retelling that we're going to look at. But that one element is the mystic tendrils that drag Sandman, the Atom, and Hawkman literally from England, or excuse me, from America to England. So I looked this up, and a flight, now this is by modern standards, this is not by 1940 standards, but by modern standards, a flight between America and England takes between 6 and 8 hours for a plane flying at over 500 miles an hour. The average is somewhere around 550 miles an hour, according to Google. So what I want to know is, for one, how long did this actually take? Because for one thing, it looks very uncomfortable to them. It literally looks like they're being dragged by wire across the Atlantic Ocean. So my other question is, you know, were they protected from like wind shear and the elements? Because I love comic books and I love the comic book tropes and I embrace all this stuff very easily, but I do have, you know, a limit to my suspension of disbelief. And these guys, even being superheroes, being bodily dragged by wire across the Atlantic Ocean is a bit of a stretch for me. So
in my mind, I saw it as a combination of like the Star Trek transporter and them being in some sort of like a protective bubble as that was happening in my mind. And again, this is just, you know, the story gives us none of that, but that's how I kind of envisioned it in my mind.
Well, it's funny you say that, because that's kind of in the retelling, that is kind of how it goes. But in this, I mean, going strictly by the visuals that we get in this story, when you look at on page 16, the way the Sandman is picked up by the tendril, but then specifically page 17, that next to last shot of them. I mean, look how uncomfortable everybody is. Everybody has this look of like, yoink, like they're just being yoinked across the friggin' ocean. I don't know. It's just one of those things. But the other thing I thought of while looking at this was, wait. This is Dr. Fate, who always seems to just be able to pull magic out of his butt whenever he needs to. Whatever ability he needs to have, he just seems to be able to have it. Does he not have the ability to port things and people, like teleport stuff? Because I thought he had that ability. Does he not?
That I don't know. So but I again, in my head, I kind of saw it as almost kind of a slightly less effective teleportation. Okay. You know, I didn't see them actually just sitting there with this rope pulling them, and they're just like, ha, da, 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 as they're going over the ocean for 16 hours.
Right. That's the thing, is how long did this take?
I'm thinking, at least the way the story presents it is, I mean, this all happens pretty quickly. So I'm thinking from the moment they were grabbed to the moment they're actually, in Dr. Fate's presence, I'm picturing, 10 minutes going by, and somehow, like I said, it's all, I know it is an insufficient explanation, but sometimes you could just shrug your shoulders and say, well, it's magic. And in this instance, I think I have to do that.
Okay, Joe Quesada. Well, my next to last note on this is, why stop here? So at the end of the story, they save Washington and the president, they form the team, and that's basically the conclusion of the story. Yes, they stop the invasion of England. However, thinking of the larger picture here, they could have put an end to Hitler. Why did they not go? And the only explanation I can think of is that we're not officially at war yet. America is not officially at war with Nazi Germany at this point. So maybe that's, I mean, they fulfilled their mission. They assisted Smythe in stopping the British invasion. I guess that's why they would stop here. But I point this out because they'd never get the chance again. Because in All-Star Squadron number 4, that's where it's established that after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hitler and Tojo use the combined MacGuffin power of the Spear of Destiny and the Holy Grail to establish a barrier around the Axis powers that would convert any American superhero who violated the zone into becoming a stooge for them, for the Nazis, for the Axis powers. So they would never have this opportunity again. They were in Nazi Germany. They were in Hitler's presence. So, and nothing was happening to them. So theoretically, they could have gone back to Germany at the conclusion of this story and stopped him right there. He
And as
was
we
hit.
mentioned, the Spectre has no compunction about killing people who are doing this evil stuff.
Right. So I almost wish I hadn't had that thought. I don't think I'd ever thought of it before, but I thought of it after reading it this time, and it almost colors the story a bit for me. And so I almost wish I hadn't had that thought, because it's like, yeah, why didn't they? Why stop here? But as it would turn out, I feel like that's kind of sort of addressed in the retelling. My absolute last note is, and this was not my catch, this was a Mike's Amazing World catch. Apparently, Hawkman is wearing the wrong mask in this story. I wouldn't know the difference, but
Well, he's got, yeah, I think at this time he would have had that yellow mask.
yeah, I guess. That was one of those things that Roy Thomas always seemed to worry way too much about, in my opinion, was what mask was historically accurate for Hawkman at what time. I could care less.
Yeah, I was recently, I think I was talking to Dave about it, the fact that in the old house, I had a shelf where I had the figures of the JSA characters that, I don't even remember what line they were. They were all from one specific line, and then I had the Superman from Kingdom Come because that was as close to the Golden Age Superman. But I had two Hawkmans. I had one with the yellow mask and one with the actual Hawk mask, and they were on each end of the run. And I don't know what happened to those figures. I certainly wouldn't have thrown them out. But I guess in my move over here, they're probably in a box somewhere in my garage.
Oh.
I hope to find them at some point. But yeah, I mean, I bought this issue off the stands, and let's see, this has got a date of, I would have been, I think, 14 when this came out. And I probably read it. I hadn't read it in years, but I probably read it about 10 times between 1977 and 1980. Because I love this issue. This has got, not only do I think I can justify it with quality, but this has got the huge nostalgia feel for me.
Right.
So
Well,
I'm hard pressed to give it any grief for the and any shortcomings we find, and that's why I think I seem to go out of my way to headcanon everything.
Well, and I was fortunate enough to meet Bob Layton for the first time at MegaCon back in 2012. This was one of the issues I took to have him sign, and I am very, very happy to have a signed copy. My number one comics creator, you know, celebrity wish list guy right now is Joe Staton. I desperately hope to meet him before he stops doing cons. And I would also like to get him to sign this book for me at some point. That would be a fanboy wish come true.
Yeah, he was supposed to be at the con on Long Island when you were here years ago.
Yeah.
For some reason it canceled that day.
Yeah, there's been a couple cons I've been to now where he was supposed to be in attendance and then couldn't make it. So I'm hoping. Well, unless you have anything more on this, I have where it's been reprinted.
Go ahead.
So this book has been reprinted first in Best of DC, number 21, which I believe is one of those digest-sized books in 1982. Superheroes number 18, 1982. I think that may be a foreign book, maybe a UK. I'm not sure what that book is. Justice Society Volume 1 trade paperback 2006. Showcase presents All-Star Comics trade paperback 2011. And All-Star Comics Only Legends Live Forever hardcover in 2019. All right, so moving on. In 1988...
No.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a foregone conclusion where we're going to land, but we have to rate this.
Oh, yes. It is a foregone conclusion, because...
Well, I'm going to give the cover a B+. Not going to, you know, so not everything's going to be the absolute top. I'm going to give the interior art an A. I'm going to give the story an A, and I'm going to give the book an A+, because it's one of my favorites of all time.
Sweet. Yeah, I'm right there with you. The book is an A+ for me. This is an absolute favorite issue of mine. Yeah, the only thing I would grade below an A+ is the actual cover. Just, you know, for the issues that we talked about. My biggest issue with the cover is just it's a little busy. That's the biggest thing. I really think... making it a wraparound would have solved pretty much all the issues I have with it. But otherwise, yeah, I love, love, love the interior art and I love the story. So yeah, absolute A+. This is a fantastic book.
Okay, now.
Okay. So in 1988, following the events of the Crisis on Infinite Earths, this story was retold in Secret Origins, third volume, number 31, in order to illustrate how it all went down in the newly established timeline. Secret Origins Volume 3, number 31, has a cover date of October 1988. It was on sale on the stands, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on June 21st, 1988, for a whopping $1.50. It sports a nice cover by Mike Baer and Robert Downs featuring 8 of the 10 heroes from the previous telling of the tale. Can you guess who's not shown? The secret origin of the Justice Society of America this time was written by Roy Thomas with art by the aforementioned Baer and Downs. Now, I am not going to re-synopsize what is essentially the same story. And by the way, there is a very odd footnote on the bottom of the opening splash that reads, adopted primarily, but not wholly, from the story in DC Special number 29. Now, I want to know, what the hell does that mean? Because not wholly, it's the same story. Anyway.
Well, I guess the logic there is that he added things.
He did. Yeah, I that's got to be what he meant. Because, yes, there's a lot of added dialogue. Anyway, let's discuss what's different about this post-crisis version. So for one, I love the art. I've always been a fan of Mike Baer, and I think I just think it's exceptionally good in this story, his artwork. While the term superhero is never used in the original story, neither is the more chronistically accurate term mystery men, and that is corrected here. They are called mystery men. The first significant difference in the telling is the absence of Batman in the photos that FDR shows to Smythe. Instead of Batman answering Gordon's bat signal summons to his office, the Flash runs from Keystone City to Gotham and meets GL in the office of Police Commissioner Davis. They still accept the mission from Smythe and travel to McMurdy Castle, just minus a now non-existent Batman. And GL still busts open the still apparently wooden castle door with his power ring. You'd think Roy Thomas, of all people, would have caught that mistake. The fight is depicted much bloodier and brutal than before, and I kind of like that. And the heroes are still kidnapped. This time, Dr. Fate does mention that he cannot attack Hitler while he holds the Spear of Destiny. The Valkyries are depicted much closer to what I've come to expect Valkyries to look like, you know, very operatic and Germanic. And the lead one is even given a name this time. There is another comment by our man this time, reaffirming the thought that Hitler cannot be harmed while in possession of the spear. Sandman, Adam, and our man are still summoned from America to aid in the fight, but at least this time they're whisked away in bubbles as opposed to bodily dragged by wire across the Atlantic. With the exception of some added and enhanced dialogue, things essentially play out the same. A bit more explanation than none at all is given to how Fate and the others link up with the Spectre and crew in Dover when they were just in Berlin a second ago. There is a nice moment of first meeting between the Spectre and Dr. Fate, although this would later be contradicted in a Spectre Year One annual story. And it's the kind of thing I would have liked to have seen more of, frankly, because first meetings of heroes, even retroactively, should be a big deal. And everyone is just kind of thrown into the mix in this story without given the time to, in most instances, even shake hands. And it's a real missed opportunity. So I like this little bonus scene that we get here. The next alteration, perhaps the biggest, is that Superman doesn't appear to smash the bomber. Of course, that guy never existed now, and so instead we get a rallying patriotic speech from Dr. Fate reminding the heroes of the spirit of America, and that allows GL to shake off mind-clouding Nazi magic, something new introduced into this one, and again, probably because of the Spear of Destiny angle, and he summons his full willpower to blow the bomber to smithereens. I gotta be honest, it's not quite the Superman moment, but it's still pretty cool. This time, rather than being clocked in the head by a wooden spear, it's the explosion of the bomber itself that knocks GL out and forces him to drop the heroes he'd been carrying via a power ring bubble. Adam still shrugs off unconsciousness and still takes a death blast meant for FDR, but this is the biggest significant difference, is without the presence of Superman to restrain the Valkyrie, this time there is nothing to stop her, and she succeeds in slaying President Roosevelt. Yep, he's dead. So while Fate and the Spectre both admit that they haven't the power to bring a man back from the far side of death, the Spectre must try anyway and retraces the path he himself recently undertook when his mortal form, Jim Corrigan, died not long ago, and he finds the soul of FDR all queued up and waiting his turn to enter the white light. He summons the voice that decreed Jim Corrigan should walk the earth as the Spectre and pleads for the life of FDR. At first, the voice refuses, but then, apparently impressed by the Spectre's unprecedented display of brashness and that a ghost could shed tears for mankind, changes its mind, and with a warning that if returned, FDR would eventually help win the war at a terrible price, but would ultimately still die like Moses of old, never seeing the fruits of his labor and sacrifice. The Spectre accepts this, is made to forget everything he just heard, and FDR is restored to life. All's well that ends well, with the Spectre this time, instead of Superman, providing the name for the nascent team, the Justice Society of America. So, historical notes from All-Star Companion Volume 4. I think there's just a couple on this, but there's some good ones here. So, since this is a post-version A post-crisis version of the JSA's origin, there could be no reference in it to either Superman or Batman, and there's not. Because Superman had saved FDR's life from a Valkyrie in the 1977 version, the president dies in the new rendition, and the Spectre must bring him back from beyond death. Yes, I just said that. Roy Thomas considers the new climax and ending to this story one of his happiest achievements in his DC years, particularly the fact that, echoing Moses at the end of the biblical Exodus, President Roosevelt would be allowed to live till nearly the end of the war, but not enter the promised land of peace. FDR died on April 12th. Oh, that's my birthday. FDR died on April 12th, 1945, as the Nazi forces in Germany were near defeat, while the Japanese were still unbeaten in the Pacific and would hold out for several more months. After this issue, it was abruptly determined at DC, and Roy still vehemently disagrees with both the decision itself and the way the matter was handled, that there should be no more Golden Age tales in Secret Origins, even though several more such had been plotted and penciled. Roy has always considered the move to have been motivated by office politics rather than sales, but as a character says in Edward Albee's play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, that's all blood under the bridge. Interesting.
Very much.
What you got on this?
Well, I did not make extensive notes on this one. the reality on this one is, if not for Crisis, I would question the need to retell the origins the way they do. Not so much on the timing. I mean, it's 11 years later. I could see them saying, well, we're going to tell it again, especially since you have a series like Secret Origins coming out, which now is focusing on exactly what that first DC special did. But again, changing the story to that dramatic effect obviously was necessitated by Crisis and the fact that Superman and Batman were, you know, being totally restarted and not part of the Justice Society. Anyway, my biggest thing that came out of this, besides just some enjoyment of the way that Roy did rejigger the facts, is I just love the artwork in this book.
Yeah.
It's funny because if we weren't doing this issue, I probably would have given the last issue an A+. But I love the artwork in this one so much that I lowered my artwork to an A in that issue, because this one feels like an A+ to me, which is unfair to that book, because as standalone, I was ready to give it an A+. But I didn't realize how much I like Mike Baer's art.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with this, I looked it up because I haven't been overly conscious of him. So I started saying, well, what else did he draw that, you know, that I know of? And then there was America versus the Justice Society. There was Infinity Inc. And some Alpha Flight in Marvel. And I mean, all terrific. This artwork has, it feels to me to be like a combination of, you know, Keith Giffen when he was doing Legion of Superheroes, and Paul Smith on the X-Men. It's got that simple thin line look, but the detail work is all there. The backgrounds are all pretty cool. The storytelling is great, and there's a lot of dramatic shots. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really comes off as almost cinematic in the way it's done, without having to be to overuse splash pages. I mean, this page, I'm just looking at a page now. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 panels on it. So he's squeezing a lot into a lot of these pages, but without losing any of the dramatic effect, which a lot of artists can't do that. A lot of artists, when they want to have the dramatic effect, they have to put splash pages and big things. This one doesn't need that. So I just feel like that's really what made this an extremely pleasant second reading of the same story.
Yeah.
You know, right after reading that one, it's not like, okay, I'm just seeing it again. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's got a whole new dimension to it. And then there are the changes in the story. I like the fact that we're doing this without Batman and Superman, not because I don't love Batman and Superman. I mean, you know, those are, as I said, the two key characters in DC Comics, but to let the Justice Society flourish without them is kind of the purpose of the Justice Society when it was in All-Star Comics. They didn't want to, you know, they wanted to give these lower level heroes a stage and not have them be upstaged by these other characters that are already totally developed and totally in the consciousness of the fans. So to give them that and to, you know, to present all of these characters in a way where, you know, they all have their moment on the stage. I think it, you know, it serves not only a purpose from just the enjoyment of reading it, but also with getting familiar with characters you might not otherwise be, and for DC's purposes with potentially making these characters more marketable. So, you know, there's many purposes to it, and I think Roy just did a great job of putting it all together. So, you know, top grades on this.
Absolutely. Yeah, on the subject of Mike Carey, he's one of those guys that's on my short list of artists where I have sought out his work, and I will collect pretty much anything that he did just because it's him. A perfect example is he did the first four or five issues of a Hellstrom series a few years ago for Marvel, a character I absolutely could not give a fart about. Yet I sought those issues out just because he was the artist, and some phenomenal stuff. So yeah, I'm a big fan of Mike Bear, and I think I first saw his stuff on, was it Young All-Stars? It was either towards the end of All-Star Squadron or Young All-Stars. I forget, but yeah, ever since I first saw his stuff, I've been a big fan, and I think he pulled out all the stops on this one. I think this just looks phenomenal. I love the giant robot fight with the giant robot versus especially Green Lantern before the Flash runs in. But that whole sequence, and then the reveal shot on page 10 of Dr. Fate watching all this happen. I mean, absolutely beautiful artwork. Some really, really great stuff.
Some of the Dr. Fate stuff almost has, you know, a more modern feel to it, but kind of like the Steve Ditko, Dr. Strange, you know, otherworldly look.
Yeah, I'm getting that. I'm getting, by the way that page is staged, I was also getting kind of a Todd McFarlane vibe, like from the very beginning of Todd McFarlane's run on Infinity.
Back when he was good.
He did a lot of experimental stuff. Like, what's that? When he was?
I said back when he was good.
Yeah, exactly.
But back when Todd McFarlane had some editorial restraints.
Yeah. But yeah, I absolutely love. And I would love to know whose decision it was on changing the tendrils to bubbles. I would love to know, was that a Roy thing? Like, that was that in Roy's notes, or was this Bear on his own, you know, Was this his decision to change it? Because I love the fact that while this is telling the exact same story, on a quick flip through, a quick flip through here, I'm not seeing anything where he simply just copied or adapted the artwork from the previous story. Everything to my quick flip through here is all original. So this is his telling of the story. He's not just simply repeating what had already been done. And I think that's pretty ballsy. I think that's pretty cool that he did it that way. And I think it really pays off. I think it's an absolutely beautiful book. Had you ever read this before?
No, this is my first time. And I honestly sat down with it thinking, okay, I'm just going to flip through it because it's just a retelling.
Right.
And then I ended up spending more time with it than I anticipated because there are the differences, and the artwork is definitely worth poring over a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned just a few minutes ago about, you know, the Steve Ditko kind of influence, and I'm just looking now that seems to manifest itself more with the Spectre.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. See, I've always been fascinated by how certain things could have played out in the post-crisis timeline. You know, certain stories, especially, you know, those stories involving, heavily involving, like, say, Superman, you know, such a key component of the entire, you know, DC story and everything. So, I mean, I've frankly spent far too much of my life thinking about this sort of thing. But there have been a few, you know, a handful of examples where somebody took the time to go back and retell a story to illustrate how it now played out without, you know, those key components. And another good example is there's an issue of All-Star Squadron right towards the end of the run that actually retells an old Superman story. But of course, Superman now doesn't exist. So how did that story play out? And that's a story I'd like us to take a look at sometime on the show, because I just think it's a lot of fun to look at the original story with Superman and then how it plays out without him. And that's neat. I kind of wish they had done more stuff like that, you know, in that era, you know, immediately post-crisis. But I thought this was really neat, the way they handled all this. And obviously, you know, without Superman, there is a big difference in the two stories. And I thought that was really cool. I did notice there's an outdated note. I don't know who's the moderator for Mike's Amazing World these days. There's no longer an email link or anything to be able to write to the website. So I don't know who handles it. But if you happen to be listening, whoever you are, there is an outdated note on Mike's Amazing World that reads, "It has not been revealed in post-crisis continuity whether Major Stryker becomes the Red Panzer as he did on Earth 2. Well, spoilers, he did. So my biggest note on this is the Young All-Stars were created by Roy Thomas on the theory that what he called the energy that had been the Earth 2, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, etc., you know, all the duplicate characters, that energy had to go somewhere, you know, because energy is neither created or destroyed, you know, it just is, and it takes other forms. So as I've interpreted his theory, it's essentially that something had to fill the void left behind when those characters were eliminated from reality or eliminated from the timeline after the crisis on Infinite Earths. And I'm like, okay, I go along with it. That follows, I guess. But then why have their energy replacements only start? Why did they only start popping up in 1942? Shouldn't they have been replaced within the same time frame that they originally existed, you know, where they left a hole? And that's one of those things that's always bothered me. So, you know, you've got, for example, Superman's energy replacement was Arn Monroe. Well, we don't meet Arn Monroe until Young All-Stars starts in sometime in 1940, I want to say like April or something of 1940, like the spring of 1942. But if he's replacing Superman in continuity, then shouldn't he theoretically be like part of a story like this? And I don't know. It's one of those things. It's like, I like Roy's theory, but then it doesn't quite work at the same time. I don't know. Does that make sense? Am I overthinking this stuff?
Oh, I think crisis requires us to overthink everything, because it's just such a complicated way of going about, you know, revamping the universe. And,
right,
you know, ultimately, you know, my biggest problem with crisis and what it did is that, okay, so now you're in, you know, 1985, 1986, around there, and you decide you're going to revamp things. You know, that works. That's all well and good, but then, you know, the time still keeps marching on and you still have continuity to deal with. Right. And it's, you know, eventually it's going to just be as complicated as it was. And, you know, and it has been. And they've tried to it's almost like they've fallen back on, let's just keep doing it over and over again with and to lesser effect as they've gone on. Yep. So a lot of times I've avoided these questions in my mind, and, you know, you nudge me and say, you know, what about this? What about that? That is a concept I hadn't thought about. And I kind of agree with your way of looking at it, that, you know, if energy can't be destroyed or created and has to be somehow compensated for, then you can't have a gap of two, three, 4 years where that energy just doesn't exist, because it has to exist in some form or another, unless somehow it's being held in stasis somewhere. But that would be a story that if they tried to write that, I think it would make everybody's head hurt.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
So it's almost like you just have to say, yeah, it doesn't make total sense, but okay, let's move on.
I mean, you know, the real world answer, of course, is that he was not going to go all the way back and retell the entire run of All-Star Squadron. And I get that, and I respect that. So, you know, that's the real world answer. But it just, so in my mind at least, then the whole energy replacement theory doesn't really work. It's an interesting idea, but it's one of those, like, when you start thinking about it, then you can if you can poke holes in it, then it doesn't really work. And that to me has always been one of those huge holes, is like, okay, you replace them, but after the fact type. I don't know, it's really weird, but anyway.
it would almost be interesting if you were to take the runs of Superman and Action Comics from 1939 until Crisis, and take all the key moments and somehow retell them in that timeline. Not, you know, do the John Byrne where you're retelling the events of Superman's life, but you're telling how these things actually transpired in the past, you know, and what, how they historically make sense without having Superman having been there.
Right.
It's a series that would probably fail miserably, because it would probably require the writer and artist team to have such a knowledge that few people have, and they'd have to dedicate so much time to getting it all right. And then the readers would probably not really appreciate that level of detail to the extent of, you know, making it all worthwhile. But it's just, conceptually, it's just a fascinating thought to take all the key moments and just kind of retell them without Superman.
It is, you know, to me, it's fascinating because, quite honestly, any time since Crisis that I read a pre-Crisis book, particularly a Superman story, I invariably spend at least a moment trying to figure out how could this possibly have happened without Superman. You know, how did this story then play out in the new timeline? You know, the post-Crisis timeline. And there are some instances where I'm like, this story just simply couldn't, these events could not have happened because of, you know, X, Y, Z. So I'm always fascinated with that. And that's why I, you know, hold a particular place in my heart for the few times where somebody did try to tell those stories. It didn't happen very often, but when it did, I was always really fascinated. Like, okay, somebody really tried and gave it some real thought of, like, how did all this play out post-Crisis, you know, now that certain key things have moved around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely the kind of thing that makes your head hurt, though.
Yes. The only other note I have on this is where it's reprinted. This has only been, according to Mike's Amazing World, reprinted once, and that was in Last Days of the Justice Society of America trade paperback in 2017.
Okay. Well, I would haven't looked for it, but I would imagine this is something you'll find in a $1 or $2 bin.
Yeah.
In all likelihood. So I would recommend it, because if nothing else, the story is excellent and the art is great. So
it is,
so, you know, beautiful. it's worth owning. And I'm going to, if I spot it as I'm going through bins, I'm planning on picking it up for myself, because I don't own a copy of it at the moment. But I'm going to say A pluses all around for, you know, it's, you can't discredit the source material that we reviewed first. So it is building on that. But instead of just retelling it, it's taking everything that's there that's good and carrying it over and then embellishing it. So to me, A plus is all around.
I will agree on that, except for the cover. I like the cover. The Atom throws the cover off for me. He looks to me like a small child who's jumping up. Like, I'm here too to make sure that he's caught in the family photo type of thing.
You have a good point there.
That's my only criticism is the Adam is just, I know he's supposed to be a tiny guy, but come on. I mean, if he was
standing... he also, as we've pointed out on several covers, he also looks like he's color formed onto it.
Yes. Yes, he does. But if he was standing flat on the ground, he looks like he wouldn't come any higher than Green Lantern's belt buckle. And come on, he's not that short, is he?
Yeah.
I don't think
he should be about his, you know, if he was standing on the ground, his head should be about where it is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He's not standing on the ground in the picture. Yeah. So yeah, he's out of proportion with the shot, yeah. Especially since he's front and center. So perspective should make him look larger than he is.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that, agreed. That is my only criticism. Otherwise, yeah. The overall book, in my opinion, is still an A+. I think it's beautiful. I think it's a very, very beautifully illustrated book. And I like what Roy did here. I mean, you know, he had a real challenge here is, you know, how do you retell the same story without key players of the story, but also how do you still tell that story and still get the same wow at the proper, I mean, because the big thing that this is missing is the Superman reveal. And while it's not the same, I do like what he went for here with instead of, you know, that moment of, oh my gosh, it's Superman. Instead, you get this very moving, very patriotic speech by Dr. Fate reminding the heroes of what's at stake here, you know, the spirit of America and all that. And I like the introduction of the effect that this, you know, Hitler holding the Spear of Destiny, you know, that would eventually, you know, be the MacGuffin, you know, with the barrier and all that. You're kind of getting a taste of that here because it's low level in this story. It's just, it's affecting their what would you call it? Like willpower, resolve type of thing. It's like making them doubt themselves and all that sort of, so it's low level, but it's enough to be holding Green Lantern back. So when Fate does this speech, then Green Lantern gets his mojo back and he has the Superman moment. So it works for me. I like that. I think that was a really clever way to, you know, work around that Superman moment, yet still kind of have it too. I thought that was pretty neat.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
But yeah, good book. And I'm glad we covered both this was a lot of fun. This got me excited about JSA stuff again.
Okay. And well, you know, with that, I'll just add, you know, this is part of JSA April or JS April, which is, you know, a huge podcasting endeavor. I'm sure this is by far the best episode in there, but I'm sure the other ones are decent too. So seek those out and listen to them. And I would actually give a thanks to Shag Matthews who coordinated all of this stuff. He is irredeemable, but he, you know, he has his moments. Thank you everybody for listening to our show. And just I'm sure I've noted it before, but we are now available on Spotify, which we had not previously been. So you could seek us out on there or seek us out on the usual places. You know, obviously everything's still available on the Two True Freaks website, but we have a new feed on Apple Podcasts. Our hopes are to get all our old episodes ported over there. I wish Dr. Fate could send some sort of a rope over to pull them over. But, you know, eventually they should be available there as well. So, you know, we'd appreciate if you guys would go on, seek us out, subscribe to us, and give us high ratings, because that's how people find us. But thank you for listening, and thank you to all the JS April people for having us as part of their presentation. And thank you, Scott, for recording this with me.
Hey, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And we'll see you all next week with something different. And we'll see you in the not-too-distant future with our regularly scheduled Legends of the Justice Society of America. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook.
Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.